The superior now informed me that having taken the black veil, it only remained that I could swear the three oaths customary on becoming a nun, and that some explanation would be necessary from her. I was now, she told me, to have access to every part of the edifice, even the cellar, where two of the sisters were imprisoned for causes she did not mention. I must be informed that one of my great duties was to obey the priests in all things, and this I soon learned, to my utter astonishment and horror, was to live in the practice of criminal intercourse with them. I expressed some of the feelings with which this announcement excited in me, which came upon me like a flash of lightning, but the only effect was to set her arguing with me in favor of the crime, representing it as a virtue acceptable to God and honorable to me. That's a passage from The Awful Disclosures of Maria Monk, or The Hidden Secrets of a Nun's Life in a Convent Exposed, a best-selling book from 1836 by a 19-year-old ex-prostitute that told of horrible sins occurring behind convent walls. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Why, in the early decades of the 19th century, did Americans display a fascination with tales of runaway nuns, sex-posés about convents, and other anti-Catholic books? How did the practice of confessional become fodder for pornography? What agenda did the ghostwriters of Maria Monk's book have? And what parallels are there between runaway nun narratives and runaway slave narratives? Joining me to explore the scandalous Maria Monk and her era is David Zimmerman, professor of English at the UW-Madison, author of a book called Panic, Markets, Crises, and Crowds in American Fiction, and of a book on complicity and the antebellum literary imagination. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
This is quite a topic, and I have to say I've never heard of Maria Monk before. What kind of brought you to this figure as to incorporate as part of your book?
Well, I became interested in the idea of complicity from the Financial Panic book, where I was interested in how writers understood the responsibility of masses, millions of investors in a financial crisis. That led me to think about writing a book on complicity. And I became interested in how language itself is seen to pass along moral complicity to listeners, to speakers, to readers, and to writers. And so I had taught and I had read Maria Monk's narrative, and it seemed perfect for that kind of exploration.
Well, let's talk about her, because there's a lot of ambiguity as to what's real and what's myth and who she really was. Was she even a nun, or did she just say she was? How much did she write this book? Let's take it back to sort of the beginning. Now, she was Canadian and born in the early decades of the 1800s?
Yeah, that's right. The historical record is mixed. So what we know comes from often salacious newspaper reports and polemics against Maria Monk. So it's not clear exactly what the facts are. It seems that she was born in or around Montreal. It seems from the record that she was indeed not only a prostitute, but a failed reformed prostitute, that she was kicked out of an asylum for reformed prostitutes. And that for whatever reason, she decided to present herself as an escaped nun from a convent in Montreal.
So that's quite a leap then from being an ex-prostitute to being a nun writing a book about being a victim.
It is, except one of the fascinating things is how closely intertwined the language of convents and the language of brothels was around this time. And this was, of course, more prevalent for anti-Catholics. It was not the case for Catholics. For anti-Catholics, they saw convents as sites of unregulated sexuality, of sexual torture, of infanticide. So it wasn't such a leap for Maria Monk as an ex-prostitute to be aware that anti-Catholics could have accepted that intertwining very readily.
Well, before we sort of back up and look at, you know, where did this anti-Catholic sentiment come from and some of the other things, let's look at the text itself, what she actually published, the 1836 text that we have, The Awful Disclosures. What's in this book and who was behind its publication?
Oh, it's a crazy book. The book seems to have been ghostwritten by two, three, four, perhaps five New York Protestant leaders that included some very well-known ministers in the city. Maria Monk seems to have gone with one of them from Montreal to New York, and there she was toured around New York. About the book itself, it is filled with an account of her deepening captivity and her deepening complicity in what she documents as the criminality inside the convent. So she enters as a young novice, a young student. She runs away, but she decides to come back and commit herself further to the Catholic Church. But what happens is the further that she commits herself, literally the deeper into the architecture of the content she's admitted, and the deeper into the content, into the convent in which she's admitted, the more serious crimes she sees. Finally, the book climaxes in an image of the convent as a kind of sexual mothership, really a brothel servicing seminarians and priests from around the area. We see in a kind of Wizard of Oz moment where the curtain lifts and we see a huge dark pit in the basement that, drawing on a long iconography of anti-Catholic writing, is where the nuns impregnated through their infant babies.
So the infant babies are killed, and the priests are forcing themselves on these young novices.
Yeah, so this was imagery that was widely circulated about the infanticide that went on and the sexual criminality that went on inside convents. One critic of Maria Monk figured that if her descriptions were true, nuns would have to give birth to babies 2.5 times a year for there to be that many babies killed that she records.
When I looked at some samples from the Awful Disclosures book, what struck me is how much it read like some of the Gothic novels I've seen around the time of Jane Austen that she was spoofing. But these ones where there are, you know, the sort of the dark hallways and you have this feeling something's going to leap out at you, or you'll open a door and discover some terrible skeleton or something. It has that tone and a bit of that same appeal to a reader's desire for suspense and horror.
It absolutely does. Some critics and scholars have called it an example of the porno Gothic. It drew on fairly formulaic genres of the time that included Gothic literature, and that would be picked up by Edgar Allan Poe, for example. It drew on an old genre of criminal confession narratives, captivity narratives, and certainly fiction of the period that trafficked in these Gothic images of hidden vice, of the immersion and the slow admission into a haunted house, for example.
What were some of the sexual crimes that were going on behind the convent walls, according to her text?
Well, one of the fascinating things is, and this is partly what interests me about the narrative, is how reticent, on the one hand, Maria Monk, as the ostensible author, is to reveal specifically what goes on, since it was considered not only wildly inappropriate, but morally dangerous to actually speak of those acts, morally dangerous to the readers and to her listeners when she spoke live. So she doesn't give specific details. She says, "I shall not tell what was transacted at such time under the pretense of confessing and receiving absolution from sin. Far more sin was often incurred in the confessional than pardoned, and crimes of a deep dye were committed. I cannot persuade myself to speak plainly on such a subject, as I must not offend the virtuous ear." So she clearly indicates, and the salaciousness of the text is only heightened by the fact that she says things too bad, too immoral, too unpure to be named.
Well, would it have been censored had she been a little bit more explicit?
Well, not exactly. Her handlers first offered the text to Harper's, which refused it exactly on those grounds. It was inappropriate. It was over-sensational. But the anti-Catholic press was virulent. It was no holds barred against Catholicism. And it trafficked in some of the most sensational and damning charges. So in that sense, no, it was not censored.
How much of an economic basis is there behind the book, too? Because I read that it was, I guess, the best-selling book before Uncle Tom's Cabin in America. I mean, it was
one of them, anyway.
It was selling a lot of copies. And so there, people are making money. Who is the desire to make money part of what's going on here, too?
That's possible. But, you know, that's not one of the reasons often cited, in even in the Catholic response. The response was simply that these ministers were over-the-top Catholic haters, that they would do anything to represent Catholicism as a conspiracy against the purity of Protestant women. But there was not so much writing about the money made, although presumably there had to be a lot made. Mm-hmm. The book came out in January 1836. I think within its first month it sold 20,000 copies. It sold, 300,000 copies by 1860, I think. It was huge. In fact, it was part of a genre of convent literature that was the best-selling literature in America in the 1830s.
Was there also a market at the time for straight-out pornography? I mean, you mentioned that this is sometimes called porno-gothic, but was there also sort of covered up in brown paper or being distributed and sort of under the radar, was there also straight-out pornography?
There was. And I've looked at it, and I've made the mistake of telling my daughter that I was looking at antebellum pornography. So now I'm known among her friends as the guy who reads pornography for work. There was a thriving pornographic industry. And among the fascinating things are that the criticism of Maria Monk, that the very exposure of sexual crimes in fact produced more sexual criminality. It incited readers and audiences to perform more sexual crimes, to be more impure, were the very same charges leveled against the anti-pornography crusaders who were activists at exactly the time. And in fact, there were some historical overlap between the New York moral reformers and the anti-Catholics.
That's interesting. Well, let's back it up and look at why in this particular period of American history, the decades leading up to the Civil War, why would there have been such strong anti-Catholic sentiment?
That's a good question. There had, in Europe, in Britain, there had always been, or for centuries, there had been a robust anti-Catholic tradition. In the United States, in the late 1780s, 1790s, there was a strong anti-Catholic tradition, but it waned, and it reemerged around this time in the 1830s. I suppose that fears of a rising tide of Catholic immigration was part of the spark.
Would that be Irish, Italian?
Irish, Italian. Mm-hmm. And as the United States expanded westward, there were deep fears among anti-Catholics that those areas would be populated by these immigrants, that, as they said, Catholicism would be a conspiracy to defraud men of all their rights and to disenfranchise and extirpate all who refused to submit to its claims. It was at this time that anti-Catholics complained that Catholicism was insinuating itself into our public councils and taking its seat among our legislators. So I think a new democracy itself provoked many fears that it could be corrupted and was being corrupted by priests who were seen as the agents of the Pope in Rome.
So the Pope and the hierarchy within the Catholic Church would have been seen as a threat to democracy in the way that a monarchy might be. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly right. The number, outside of the threat against women's purity, the chief charge against Catholicism by the anti-Catholics was that it was anti-democratic, that Catholics were subservient and slavish to the will of priests who were beholden to the will of the Pope, that it was an absolute tyranny, that it was a conspiracy, that it conducted its business behind closed doors, unavailable to the transparency of a democratic republic.
At the same time, you've got a country that is promoting freedom of religion, so it seems like quite a contradiction. If you say that we have freedom to believe what we want, but then are targeting Catholics. How did various people on the anti-Catholic side explain that sort of dichotomy?
I don't have an exact answer. They probably defended themselves by saying that they were, in fact, protecting religion because Protestantism and its different denominations provided the only true religion, that Catholicism was, in fact, not a religion, they might have said, even though in 1850 it was the largest Christian denomination in the nation. So perhaps they might have granted that Catholics had a right to preach and had a right to publish. But perhaps even in the spirit of the freedom of religion and the freedom of the press, the Protestants thought that they themselves were free to persuade America to shun Catholics and not to read their works.
But isn't there an irony if you have the widest readership for this book, The Awful Disclosures of Maria Monk, and presumably for some of the other books you're talking about that are all about the Pope going into the White House and so on, if you have Protestants reading about these salacious things, reading about torture and murder and sexual crimes, there's kind of a irony that they're fascinated by the very thing they're condemning.
That's exactly right. And they were fascinated. Part of the fascination was clearly prurient, that there was clearly a pornographic paling in comparison to today's pornography, of course, but at the time, quite vivid, quite lurid. It was consistent with the pornography of the time. They were fascinated not only by the pornography, but they were also fascinated by the apparent secrecy of this sexuality going on behind closed doors, behind convent walls. So it was the very seeming hiddenness of it that partly fascinated them. But there was absolutely an irony that here they were condemning the sexuality of the convent, and their own narratives were absolutely filled with intimations, at least, of sex and sensational happenings.
And I saw some little blurb from the time period where it's encouraging all men, all fathers and husbands to read The Awful Disclosures of Maria Monk so they can protect their wives and daughters, but not to let them see it. Not, you know, in other words, this is something that was being promoted for men to read. It's almost like an excuse to read something pornographic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. On the one hand, you had critics in the newspapers saying things like Maria Monk's book worked up the very passions described and held up for reprobation, and that it would make the wickedness of the heart 10,000 times more wicked, and how books like hers, instead of deterring or dissuading, are the most powerful, I'm reading now, are the most irresistible, most wonderful stimulants to all the guilty indulgences they picture forth. And so it was indeed an irony that husbands and fathers were directed by anti-Catholic authorities to pore over pornography so that they could the comparison would be this. If anti-Catholic or Catholic literature were like a moral epidemic, anti-Catholics urged fathers and sons to go to the epicenter because they were somehow more immune or could be inoculated. Women's ears were considered delicate. Their sensibilities were considered so fragile that women by no means were expected or allowed to read this material. And so you're right that fathers tasked with regulating female sexuality, tasked with censoring this from their daughters and their wives. This is an example. One of the most scandalous and sensational texts of the period was an anti-Catholic reproduction of the questions asked in the Catholic confessional. And this was the epicenter of Catholic contagion. This was really the source of the pestilence. And the question was, well, who was supposed to read this anti-Catholic book that detailed exactly the sexual questions that women were not supposed to hear? And the editor of the book put out this comment. although it is without doubt the most filthy and obscene work that was ever published in the English language, it is still a work that every father and husband in these United States should read. Men have preferred that their wives and daughters should have its atrocious doctrines breathed into their ears by the polluted and polluting lips of licentious priests in the secret chambers of the confessional, than to the book itself being received into their families at home. If any of those fathers knew the questions which a Romish priest put to those children at confession, I cannot even think of those questions, much less name them without a downcast eye and a crimsoned cheek, and particularly those which are put to young and unmarried ladies. Fathers, mothers, guardians, and husbands of these converts, fancy to yourselves the most indelicate, immodest, and libidinous questions which the most immoral and profligate mind can conceive. Fancy those ideas put into English. These were the kinds of texts that fathers and sons and brothers were asked to pore over in order that they knew what to protect their sisters and daughters from.
I was just going to say, read it and then forbid it. We're going to need to talk about the concept of women and the sort of delicacy they seem to have been associated with. And we'll do that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. We deplore the intimate acquaintance and promiscuous conversation of females with regard to things which ought not to be named, by which that modesty and delicacy, which is the charm of domestic life and which constitutes the true influence of women in society, is consumed. That's from a pastoral letter in 1837. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with David Zimmerman. And we're talking about the scandalous Maria Monk and the whole phenomenon of anti-Catholic literature and narratives about runaway nuns and so on coming from the early decades of 19th century America. Let's talk about women, because you have this – I've seen pictures from Harper's Bazaar of even the dresses that women wear, where they're down to the floor and almost every inch of skin is covered. And this notion of a woman as someone who really needs to be protected because she's such a delicate plant. Tell us about the notion of women at this time when legally they don't have much more rights than children.
It's interesting. They don't have more rights than children, but middle class women were considered to exert a powerful influence on families and on the culture. But they were supposed to exert this influence from within the home, from their delicacy, from their sincerity, from their transparency. So it was their moral suasion within the home that was supposed to exert their influence. But because they were consigned to exert this influence within the home, there were strictly policed boundaries between the private and the public. And so you're exactly right that any print about sex, any newspaper, any book about sex that was circulating in public was not supposed to enter the home where it might offend or breach the delicate ear of women. Women's ears were considered delicate. It's fascinating how women were supposed to exert a kind of conscientious deafness. And there were different images of women and their vulnerability to sexual print and sexual language. On the one hand, women's minds and women's conscience were thought of as almost castles under siege from sin and from sexuality. And so they were to maintain the ramparts of virtue. On the other hand, women were also seen as harboring sexual thoughts, almost like a slumbering volcano. And the conscientious deafness, ministers would say, innocence can only live in innocence. A pure woman never knows the existence of such things as sex. She ought not to know it. And in fact, women's ears were considered delicate enough that laws against insulting women were twice as much enforced as laws against rape.
Oh,
in the early 19th century.
So it was more enforceable if you insulted a woman verbally than if you raped her?
It was more enforced. That's exactly right. In 1837, the same year as the pastoral letter, a minister wrote, "In the female character, there is no mid-region. It must exist in spotless innocence or else in hopeless vice." If women's virtue was like a barrier against invasion, or if women's virtue was supposed to contain a slumbering volcano within, women's virtue was also considered like a match that once lit was irreversible and dangerous.
And how much of that is, do you think, kind of trying to read between the lines about it, would you say is a desire to preserve a kind of double standard where a wife would remain chaste and except with her husband? It's sort of a way of controlling daughters so they remain virgins, wives so they didn't cheat on their husbands, that this was a culture of keeping women from sort of wanton behavior.
That's exactly right. It was pretty clear from the literature of the period, especially the religious literature of the period, that female sexuality was being policed pretty carefully, and that fathers, husbands, even brothers were supposed to enforce this double standard because, on the one hand, women were not supposed to know about sex, and on the other hand, women were supposed to be mothers, since as mothers, they trained the next generation to be good Americans and moral Americans. And one interesting site where this double standard becomes evident is in the idea of blushing, where if you think about the art of or the act of blushing, women on the one hand were supposed to blush if they heard something offensive or immoral, but they were not supposed to know what was immoral about what they heard. And so the blush was on the one hand some sort of unconscious expression of their being insulted or morally injured or offended, and yet it was also supposed to indicate that it was unconscious, that they were not conscious of exactly what it was that was offending them.
Now, you mentioned earlier that there was this notion of the convent as not that different from a brothel, which seems sort of hard to wrap my head around, because I would think if you are trying to promote a culture of innocence and chastity and sort of freezing a young woman at a place of absolute purity, wouldn't a convent have appealed to those promoting those virtues?
It might have, except it perverted those ideals. So, for example, women in convents, they might have been chaste, but they were also not supposed to be mothers, right? And if the goal of moral womanhood was to become a proper mother, then a Catholic nun perverted that ideal. Even the idea, and Maria Monk exploits this, of the mother superior perverted the notion of mothers, since, of course, there were not supposed to be any babies, any children born into the convent.
Well, let's talk about the confessional, too, which you've alluded to just a little bit. But let's say you have a convent with these young women. Presumably, they wouldn't have too much to confess. And Maria Monk seems to imply that the confessional became a source of salacious ideas and a way that priests could get their hands on, literally, the young nuns.
That's exactly right. The anti-Catholic fears that were spread throughout the literature focused on what happened inside this hidden private world of the confessional. The fear was that lecherous priests, their own sexual appetites inflamed by their celibacy, would ask these young girls questions unthought and unheard of. And what was fascinating is how these questions were imagined to implant the very idea of sin in these women's minds, that these girls might not have had much to confess, but that sin or immorality, an understanding of sex acts even, was implanted in their minds, and furthermore that having been implanted in their minds would slowly but surely make them not only willing but wanting to perform those sex acts with those priests. And so priests were called geniuses of seduction. The confessional was called a school of vice. And the perverse aspect of the confessional was that because these women were taught to obey priests in all things, and because they were taught that priests could offer absolution for their sins, the very sins performed in the confessional were also absolved within the confessional. So there was a vicious circle that almost all Protestant commentators about the confession remarked on. No man who habitually visits the brothel and spends his days and his nights in the most criminal and abandoned practices could ever ask or wish for a more extensive license for iniquity than the confessional. No person can feel any surprise at learning that a practitioner under it takes the confession and grants absolution to the miserable partner in his guilt, who he has just before indulged in a grossly criminal intercourse within the walls. And you asked about Gothic literature. There were some of the most Gothic passages in anti-Catholic fiction. Here is a passage from a girl in an anti-Catholic novel. Under the pretense of cautioning me against sin, the priest taught me the most loathsome sensuality and unfolded the very inmost recesses of all ungodliness until, having molded me in unprincipled views and feelings to his design, he completed it in the confessional. I was then totally in his power and was removed to his parish where my son was born.
Oh, boy. Are there some attempts to link women's weakness to these stories, these temptations and so on, to the figure of Eve? In other words, are the priests being presented almost as satanic?
It's a great question. The iconography of Eve, of course, was old. Eve as easily vulnerable, Eve as tempted, as Satan whispering in her ear. So you would think that the image of priests literally whispering into the ear, a common image of these young girls, would be figured as satanic, and implicitly it certainly was. But explicitly it was not. They were called devilish, they were called demonish, but they were rarely linked specifically with the biblical Satan.
Why do you think the confessional was such a target? Is it the secrecy in particular about it, or was it just an excuse to go after an isolated Catholic practice? So if you want to attack Catholicism, you take elements that are different, and that's one of them.
I think it was all of those things. On the one hand, because it was behind convent walls, a private space within this private space, I think it attracted extra attention and roused extra anxieties. I think because it ostensibly or really involved young women, teenage girls, that was a sight, a fraught sight, where Protestant men in particular thought about women's sexuality and women's corruption, which was a big deal. The fate of the nation, they saw, the fate of Protestantism against Catholicism was at stake in maintaining the sexual purity of young women, of girls who were going to become older women and mothers. So I think the confessional brought all of those anxieties together.
In our own time, of course, we know the Catholic Church has been rocked with scandals and allegations of abuse and so on. Is there some truth behind some of the reports that existed in something like the disclosures of Maria Monk? In other words, if you look at it just historically and factually, were there enough incidents that have been corroborated of young nuns getting impregnated and various, you know, murders of people or babies or different things happening? Were there some actual scandals that gave some truth to the what then became so sensationalized and exaggerated?
There may have been, and undoubtedly some criminality, some assaults had to take place then as now. I don't see any reason why that would be different. I don't know, however, of actual cases that corroborated these sensational, exaggerated images. And because the literature is so saturated with these exaggerations, it's hard to parse through them and to figure out what in fact is true, what really did happen or didn't happen.
At the time that, you know, these anti-Catholic narratives are coming out, you also have a lot of schools that are taught by nuns where they, you know, Protestant children are going to these schools because they have a reputation for being excellent schools. So how did the people who were promoting this anti-Catholic literature, how do they handle convent schools?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That one of the truths is that Protestant parents were, in fact, sending their young girls to Catholic schools. And anti-Catholics feasted on this. And they talked about these parents as the moral assassins of their children. They talked about these parents as performing the work of the Pope in spreading Catholic ideas and Catholic doctrine through their children. There was also a class dimension to this, where it was wealthier parents who sent their children to the convent schools. And so some of the anti-Catholic literature, some of the anti-Catholic riots were class-based, where they both appealed to or were enacted by a working-class audience that felt a clear resentment against the wealthier Protestant families.
And what difference did it make that Maria Monk was Canadian as opposed to American? Did that make her even more of a sort of a figure that could be attacked?
I think so. I think it made her a very easy victim, and it allowed her to be at once sexualized and impure while a victim purified through her expose, precisely because she wasn't American. It would have been harder, perhaps, for an American woman, although many did, to step forward and claim this kind of sexual vulnerability and sexual injury, any sort of taint that attached to her. It seemed much easier to an American audience to attach to a young Canadian woman.
And why was there not more of an effort to check the facts? In other words, if Maria Monk was actually a 19-year-old ex-prostitute who never had been a nun, but then people are buying a book and reading it as if she had been, why was there not sort of instant discrediting, you know, especially if she were invited to speak somewhere? Maybe she didn't do sort of a book tour equivalent.
In fact, she did do a book tour equivalent. For almost 2 years, she was trotted out on stage throughout New York by the anti-Catholic press, and there was a media frenzy. She was an absolute media sensation precisely because of the scandalous nature and the increasingly reckless bids for attention. On the one hand, an anti-Catholic editor trotted out another alleged nun who was supposed to have been with Maria Monk in that very convent. And this woman, too, was later presumed to be an ex-prostitute. Part of the media frenzy was, in fact, trying to confirm or disprove her charges. One of the fascinating things is how she insisted that anybody who visited that convent, which was a real convent, it existed in Montreal, with her book in hand, would be able to see the traces of the truth. Later, she amended that. She said, no doubt the priests, in order to absolve themselves of these charges and to clear themselves, will have remodeled the interior of the convent. She said, but still, we will be able to see traces of the criminality, traces of the truth. So not just once, but twice, impartial ministers with her book in hand visited that convent, both times saying, no, there's no similarity between her book and the convent. There's no evidence from her book that any of this actually happened. And in fact, from people who supposedly or claimed to have known her in Montreal, they were the ones who charged that she was in fact in an asylum for reformed prostitutes in Montreal, and that she got her description of the Montreal convent, not from the convent, she had never been in that, but from this asylum for reformed prostitutes. So in addition to the other equations between convents and brothels and nuns and prostitutes, here, literally again, her image of the convent came from an image of a prostitute asylum.
We're going to find out what happened to Maria Monk when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Her Filthy Imaginings are productions of a mind familiarized by long intimacy with the interior of brothels to scenes of bestial pollution and disgorging its filthy imaginings upon a credulous public. Her tales will soon take their place among obscene works, read only for the provocation of the baser passions, the impure imaginations, which love such unchaste and monstrous details. That's from a review from the Popular Press of The Awful Disclosures of the Nunnery by Maria Monk from 1836. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with David Zimmerman. We've been talking about this sensational best-selling book from the 1830s that seemed to go along with anti-Catholic sentiment. And, you know, sort of lost in all of that is the actual woman, Maria Monk, who seems to have been used by her ghostwriters and by the press to sell books and to fuel a kind of sensation. And, you know, just looking at her dates, it's clear that she didn't live very long. What do you know about the end of her life after the sort of two-year media frenzy that you were talking about?
Yes, on, you know, 1836, 1837, at the height of her popularity, there were always suspicions about her. And she became such a public figure, her bids for attention so sensational that pretty soon, pretty much everybody except her handlers no longer believed her and abandoned her. She gave birth publicly to two children, unwed. That didn't help her case. And she ended her life arrested in a whorehouse, I believe in New York. So giving judicial warrant, I suppose, to the accusation that she had, in fact, been a prostitute in Canada.
I noticed that a lot of the language about the situation in the convents and so on uses words like infectious, pollution, disease, contagion. Was part of that actually reflecting the spread of venereal disease?
It was. It was a common anti-Catholic trope. And in particular, in Monk's case, her image of the convent did include, like many convents did, a convent hospital. And the convent hospitals often treated prostitutes and treated them for venereal disease. In Monk's representation of the hospital, in the Montreal convent, that's where the priests went to be treated for the venereal disease that they contracted with the nuns in the convent. And in her imagining, the convent becomes this swirling epidemic space where on the one hand, hundreds of priests and priests in training come into the convent. They speak in the confessional with these young women. They have sex with them. They both contract and communicate this disease. And then behind the walls, in what the book Riley calls the holy retreats, and it's a pun because on the one hand they are a holy retreat and on the other hand they are being retreated for their venereal disease. And so the convent itself replicates that vicious circle of the confessional where sin is both performed and supposedly absolved. In the case of the venereal disease, the diseases both spread within the convent through the bodies of the nuns, but also treated in the holy retreats.
Another kind of literature right around the same time that's coming out that's exposing sin and corruption and pollution has to do with slavery, where you have people writing or speaking about how the practice of a white slave owner impregnating one of his slave women, that that is morally corrupting the entire system, and you know, the sin of that, because it promotes adultery and spreads disease and so on. What is the relationship that you see, if any, between these convent narratives and then what's happening in real life America, which is the brutality of slavery filled with rape?
That's a good question. It's interesting that around this time in the 1830s, any exposés, any complaints about the sexual assaults and the rapes of slave owners, those exposés and accusations were themselves considered indelicate and were not supposed to be exposed. So around this time, you don't have many people exposing in print that sexual criminality on the plantation. An exception in 1836, 1837 are the Grimke sisters, famous abolitionist sisters who grew up in the South and then in Philadelphia are abolitionists, and they expose and they call out Southern plantation owners for precisely allowing, if not themselves doing, performing these rapes. And the sisters were savaged in the press for revealing these things, precisely for upsetting the delicate ears of their audience that no woman was supposed to know these things, no woman was supposed to speak these things, no woman was supposed to read these things. And they, in turn, replied to their critics. They said, "These northern women who feel, who cannot bear that their delicate ears should be pained by the screams of the poor sufferers of the slave women." And in doing this, they likened the northern women whom they considered prudes, those who would not want such sexual criminality exposed, they likened those women to the actual men who whipped and raped those poor women.
Because they were complicit?
Because they were complicit.
If they were refusing to hear, if they were practicing what I think you called earlier conscientious deafness.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so if they were, for the sake of preserving their virtue, not hearing reality, not letting reality intrude into their sacred space, they were, in fact, propagating the evil?
That's exactly right. And so among the fascinating things, on the one hand, those people who exposed moral viciousness or moral vice were condemned themselves for being unclean. There's a biblical line from Job that nothing clean can come out of anything unclean. That was the charge against moral reformers. The converse was also true for those who were considered prudish or those who did not want to reveal these, that in the case of the Grimkes charged them exactly with complicity, with perpetuating these evils and these sins.
Interesting. And what do you see? I mean, this is from a long time ago. We're in the 1830s. What do you see as you're working in this time period with these texts and these reviews and so on? Do you have these aha moments where you think, you know, that has a lesson for today, or there's something that has continued from that time into our own present or in other areas of the globe where you see some parallels?
I think so. On the one hand, there's always hysteria about conspiracies. So conspiracy thinking still goes on, still remains dangerous in many cases. For me, one of the most interesting carryovers in today's world is thinking about how certain kinds of information about dangerous things, that information itself is considered dangerous. So information about sexuality in sex ed, for example, in the schools, is often condemned for spreading the very so-called evil or the very action that it is meant to curb. Or in the case of information about terrorists, where that information itself is not allowed to come out to the public for fear that it will propagate, that it will spread knowledge about terrorism, that it will spread the appeal of terrorism to certain listeners.
Or specific ways to conduct
terrorist
acts. Or
specific ways. Exactly right.
Interesting. What about the sort of anti-Catholic sentiment? Do you find sort of equivalent things where you have the propaganda against a particular group and then finding someone to trot out?
Sure. We see that all the time in the press with radical Islam, where we see in American press in particular drumming up hysteria against Islam, against Muslims, especially against radical Islam, and, as you said, trotting out the more sensational and more dangerous embodiments of that supposed danger.
And as you've been working on this material, what surprised you the most when you were reading Maria Monk and the other kind of runaway nun narratives and things that are about the things that are happening behind convent doors? What surprised you?
That's a good question. I guess I was a naive reader, naive about the 1830s, naive about the print culture of the time, and I was surprised and shocked by the sexuality. I was surprised and shocked how bold it was, even if it pales by today's standards. It was still very out there for the time. And so its very sensationalism surprised me.
And so if your daughter's friends that you mentioned that now view you as the man who reads pornography for work ask you about that, how do you explain the sort of the value in it? You're an English professor. This is not literature exactly. This is not Moby Dick. It's not Pride and Prejudice. What is the sort of value in poring over texts that were bestsellers but in a sort of grocery store way?
Sure. Part of the value is historical. There's ample warrant for studying this literature. It was the best-selling literature at the time. So simply to understand American literary culture and American literary history, it's important to be familiar with this literature. It's important to be familiar with American culture of the time. There's some students, some adults still imagine the 1830s and the 1840s to be some sort of pure period where people didn't know about sex or criminality. And of course they did. That justifies our learning about it. And I would also tell my daughter and her friends that it's important to think about how people become complicit in injury, in social harms, in evil, if we use that language, and some of the oblique ways that people are seen to participate in sin or participate in evil, including by the very language they use. And I would explain myself that way, I think.
My guest has been David Zimmerman. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.